On the Money is recommended for mature audiences only. It may and probably will contain explicit financial language, strong business themes, economic violence, coarse financial accounting, nudity, and credit references.
Hello and welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program...
They're a little bit surprised on what's required of them to get the loan that maybe 4 or 5 years ago was really much, much easier to get. I think it's those businesses that have to, I guess, adjust to this new environment.
Yeah, the squeeze is on small business to get finance in the post-Royal Commission environment. And we look at how they'll have to operate to get the finance they need in the future. Also coming up on the program tonight...
Commission-based selling is so deeply embedded in the financial services sector. I would describe it as being like an addiction.
Yes, with the Hayne Royal Commission wrapping up, it appears commissions for brokers and other financial advisors have been the cause of many of the excesses presented on the commission. We find out why. All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, while rental prices in Sydney seem to be easing, a new report says that rental affordability in capital cities is getting worse. It's having a greater strain on the hip pocket of renters who haven't seen a real increase in wages for a very long time. Daniel Ellison has the story.
According to the Rental Affordability Index, which was released today by SGS Economics and Planning along with National Shelter, Community Sector Banking and the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, Sydney and Hobart are the most expensive capital cities for rentals in Australia. The housing market may have peaked, easing the stress on rental prices, but according to the report released today, Sydney is second only to Hobart as the most expensive city for low-income renters. Karen Walsh, from Shelter New South Wales, says the real impact of high rents on those already living in low-cost housing can be devastating.
They're paying 60, 70, even more percent of their income in rent, and that doesn't leave very much for them to, you know, buy food, pay for transport. And for example, people that are job seekers on New Start, single pensioners, for them, the median rent of a one-bedroom unit is 128% of their income. Now, you tell me how that is something that we as a society can live with. This is a, you know, it's an important...
The crisis in housing affordability is not just affecting our capital cities, but regional Australia as well.
Across Australia, there is currently a shortage of 433,000 affordable houses. And by about 2036, we need 727,000 low-cost rental homes.
According to Ellen Witts from SGS Economics and Planning, this is an issue that has been generations in the making.
Well, that's quite a big task that we have ahead of us. I think the situation that we're in at the moment has been evolving and developing over a few decades. It's really since the late 90s that we've seen quite a disturbing change in public policy priorities. First of all, we got the combined introduction of the capital gains tax reduction and negative gearing, and that has skewed the property market towards investors, at the same time pushing out would-be homeowners onto the rental market.
But that state and federal bodies have not been treating housing affordability like the crisis it truly is. And the lack of public housing shows that government does not prioritise the things that vulnerable people need.
The government decided to invest less and less in social housing. So Back in 2000, 6.5% of the housing stock was social housing. Now it's down to 4.4. So ideally, we would want to see 10 to 15% of all dwelling construction to be for social housing. Task ahead. So part of the answer is looking at how we treat treat housing. Housing should be a place to provide people a roof over their heads first, and maybe an investment objective second. And at the moment, those two policy priorities are the other way around.
Ms. Walsh says that government prioritizes spending to those who have more influence on the outcome of elections.
Necessarily. So governments do make choices about where they put their money. For example, in New South Wales, they decided to spend, you know, God knows how much money on sports stadiums, when homelessness has increased by 37% since the last census, 2011 to 2016. Homelessness figures in New South Wales went up by 37%. And that's in a context of record delivery of market housing. So there's something really wrong in the policy system and how decisions are being made about where money is spent. So
Shelter New South Wales is gearing up to campaign for the next state election, and they have a plan to effect real change in the city of Sydney.
In New South Wales. So we're actually calling on all parties and all governments to commit to fixing the housing system once and for all before this crisis becomes an absolute disaster. And our first ask is for New South Wales for the delivery of 5,000 social housing properties, new homes, in addition to the existing social housing supply. And we want those 5,000 additional houses to be delivered every year for the next 10 years.
The New South Wales government is also in a good financial position and has the money to fix an issue affecting the one-third of residents currently renting in New South Wales.
Actually takes political will, and it actually takes a lot of capital investment. We know that governments, New South Wales has had windfall gains in stamp duty and land tax, billions of dollars over the recent years through the increase in market housing. So we're actually calling for some of that money to be invested in housing for low-income renters, social affordable housing in Sydney and in the regions where people are really finding it tough.
So yep. You share it. Please do.
Yep. So another key thing is the governments, especially state governments, can use the planning system by introducing things like inclusionary zoning, where as part of any large developments, housing or commercial, developers are required to provide a certain share of affordable housing. So in that way, it's not all the government that needs to pay for it.
I think it's important also to notice that it's not just people on benefits or pensioners,
although they are suffering quite significant. It's often also working families, single parents that have a job, that are really suffering a lot. For instance, a single mother who might work part-time and be on benefits, she would be paying 70% of her income on rent in Greater Sydney in order to enter a rental agreement.
One thing that is certain is that housing affordability and the real cost of rent and income are going to be issues facing all Australians going into the future, and it is important that the government address this.
So that's been undertaken by AHURI. You know, they're a credible research organisation. The evidence is clear. This is an urgent need. And WestConnex, all of those other infrastructure projects, in accordance with, you know, good planning and good place planning, creating places where people can live, every community needs to have a social mix where people, regardless of your income, regardless of your age, everybody needs to be able to live in a community where they can access services, they can access infrastructure, they can access transport. So we don't just want to see communities that only deliver homes or infrastructure for those that are already advantaged, that are already homeowners, or that have already got two or three investment properties. We want to see communities being developed and created really well, not only in Sydney, but in the regions, because this problem is also spreading out to the regions. It's not only a Sydney issue. We actually want to see smart cities that are livable cities that we can actually be proud of and that people can live in and access services regardless of who they are.
Karen Walsh, CEO of Shelter New South Wales and Vice Chairman of the National Shelter Executive, ending that report by Daniel Ellison. I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to On The Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network.
It's business time.
Yes, and a third of small businesses felt it was relatively difficult for them to access finance, up from just 20% on the September quarter last year, according to 2018 Census Business Index. With nearly a third of small businesses affected, Kevin Suarez, our CEO of Census, John Allen, why these companies are struggling to access finance.
Well, look, what we saw in the Census Business Index is that we measure their response on how easy it is to access finance, so either easy or hard. And what we saw in the most recent index is that the incidences of being hard have grown dramatically. So the net score of that survey showed a 17-point drop in the ease of accessing finance into a fairly negative territory. What small businesses are telling us is that off the back of the banking inquiry, their ability to get finance easily has changed. Now, if you sort of pull that apart a bit further, we primarily see it in the small businesses. So businesses sort of below 200 employees, or about 100 employees, were most affected. And the reason why is because many of them will use their home loan or their mortgage on their existing assets as a way to get finance for their business. So what we believe is many of them have sort of got caught up in a more rigorous and changed process within the banking industry, and that's flowing through down to small businesses, which, as the data's indicating, are getting, I guess, finding increasingly hard to access finance, which is, you know, quite worrying in the data set for this quarter.
Would you say that the Banking Royal Commission has anything to do with, or a major part of, why these companies are struggling to access finance, or at the very least, their confidence in accessing it?
Agree, we do. What's interesting is we've been doing this survey for 25 years, so access finance has been a key question for a number of decades now, and we've seen two quarters of a material drop in the confidence of accessing finance. Now, this is quite unique. When all the other indicators for small businesses like wages, profits, sales are actually really positive, and in some areas of Australia growing, this two-quarter quite material drop, we would suggest, is absolutely linked to the banking inquiry. And as I said, you know, for small businesses, many of them are using either their home loan or existing assets to get access to finance for their business. And if that is slowed down, or the process takes longer, or requires them to provide more evidence around what the banks might require, that does make it more difficult for them. And then I think the question for a small business is, of course, many of them will be, of course, talking to their bank, but at the same time, they're probably going to non-bank lenders, many of whom maybe have a more speedier process than what they might be experiencing with the banks.
Looking at the figures, the sort of issues regarding accessing finance, as well as their confidence in it, seems to persist across every mainland state and territory. So how do the Tasmanian SMBs perform differently?
You're right. Tasmania was the only state where actually the data improved for this. Now, Tasmania is quite unique at the moment. We're seeing very, very high confidence levels in Tasmania businesses at the moment. Their economy is absolutely doing incredibly well. Businesses in Tasmania have come off a bit of prolonged period of perhaps lower growth. And, you know, many would say actually Hobart and Tasmania is having a bit of a boom at the moment. So that's making businesses incredibly positive about what's going on there. Also, you know, remember, I guess, that your trading results of your business and how well your business is doing probably is a key factor in the data that a bank or someone might use to assess whether a business should get finance. And so trading conditions across most of the business sectors in Tasmania are really, really strong. So that could be playing into the reason why Tasmania is a little bit unique to the rest of the country. And what we saw in the rest of the country is the results in all other states and territories dropped. In fact, the worst drop we saw actually was in Victoria. Now, economically, Victoria is doing pretty well, and business confidence is pretty good in Victoria. It has softened a little bit from the last quarter, but still in really positive territory.
So what still needs to change in how SMBs are accessing their finances or their confidence to access it?
Look, I think the issue, my belief is that it will rebalance at some point as the banking inquiry finishes and as businesses perhaps adjust to the way that banks want to process and accept loans and the information they require. And of course, the banks want to loan money. You know, they want to loan money to people who can repay it. So I suspect as the banks rethink their processes, of course, they want to make the experience for customers better and easier and simpler. So I think the banking industry will perhaps adjust more effectively over the short term. Businesses do want to loan money, but what I would say is some of them at this time might be reassessing when they go to a bank or a non-bank lender as a consequence of this aberration that we're seeing in the market right now.
So looking at the figures, it says that just under about 40% said that they're not confident in their access to finance, but approximately 60 to 65% still fairly confident in accessing their finance. So what is it that these 65% of respondents are doing that is perhaps something that the 35% could take on?
Your business is larger than smaller businesses, your ability to get access to finance seems easier. And in fact, their numbers indicate really positive results for accessing finance. There's no doubt it's really impacting those smaller businesses. So I think that's one key factor in the data. I do think one of the challenges, of course, is that as the banks have perhaps asking for more information and more time to consider a loan, I think small businesses, those that are having success, have adjusted to that quite well. So have their records in good shape and can give them to the bank quickly and perhaps, you know, have perhaps a better relationship with their bank to be able to access finance or their lender. So I think it's those factors that are helping those businesses. I think for others where, you know, maybe you've got a small business and you haven't had to get a loan from someone for, you know, 3 or 4 years, and the last time you got a loan, maybe it was much easier. Now what's happened, of course, is they're a little bit surprised on what's required of them to get the loan that maybe 4 or 5 years ago was really much, much easier to get. I think it's those businesses that have to, I guess, adjust to this new environment.
CEO of Census, John Allen, speaking there with Kevin Suarez. Commissions have long been part of the financial advice sector, with the big banks and insurers paying financial advisors a cut of a policy or a loan taken out by a customer. But the commissions have been revealed in the Hayne Royal Commission to be a large contributing factor to misconduct, and it's led to financial advisors and financial institutions making sales of products ill-suited to their customers. Vincent Sue spoke with Paul Johnson, Warden and Director of the Forest Research Foundation and Professor of Economic History at the University of Western Australia, to find out more.
The problem with commissions as applied to the financial services industry, the whole industry, is that people go to an advisor or a bank or an insurance company expecting that organization or that individual to put the client's interest above everything else. But if the bank or the insurance company or the advisor is earning a commission, they will tend to be driven by their own self-interest, how to maximize the commission, rather than to deliver advice that is in the best interest of the client. We know this happens. Both the Royal Commission and the Productivity Commission have demonstrated that in fact, the Productivity Commission has found that in the majority of cases that they have looked at in terms of financial advice delivered to Australians, the advice was not necessarily in the client's best interest. It was biased advice. And in at least 10% of cases, the clients were significantly disadvantaged by the advice they were given. So they were paying to be in a sense, to be dudded by the financial advisors. That's outrageous. And it's driven by the commission-based selling of product.
And this is banks handing out commissions to, say, mortgage brokers and people like that?
It's banks handing out commissions to mortgage brokers. It's insurance companies handing out commissions. It's financial advisors earning commissions from the variety of companies and providers that offer a whole range of financial products. Commission-based selling is so deeply embedded in the financial services sector. I would describe it as being like an addiction. The sector is addicted to commission-based selling. And I should say that there are no surprises, really should be no surprises for anyone, that commission-based selling leads to mis-selling. Because back in 1826, almost 200 years ago, one of the first books written about the financial services sector and the selling of products to consumers, it was a book about life insurance, clearly identified this problem. It said that the people who were receiving commissions to sell life insurance policies were essentially receiving a bribe. That was the language used in 1826. I think that language is equally applicable to Australia today in 2018.
So if commissions are the problem, will banning commissions in the industry work?
I think the first step to clean up the financial services industry is to say there should be no commission payments for the sale of any consumer financial product, whether it be a mortgage, whether it be a loan, whether it be a life insurance policy, whether it be general financial advice. It's fine for people to pay for advice, but that advice should be paid for up front so that people know what they're paying for and know what they are getting. Most people would be outraged to know that the life insurance broker who sells them life insurance or indeed some other policy is earning hundreds, maybe thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars over the life of that product. And the consumer is almost entirely unaware of this. And they wouldn't be prepared to pay that much in the main for the service they get. Absolutely fine to pay money for a good service. But you need to know what the service is, and then you can know what the price is, and then you can compare between the different providers.
So what sort of system should replace commission-based sales in Australian banks?
If you think about the way in which we buy most products, most services, there is a price for the service, and the salary of the person both providing and administering that service is rolled into the price of the product by the provider. And that's what we would expect if we're buying services from a lawyer or from a doctor or from a supermarket. You don't go to a supermarket and then they say, oh, by the way, we're going to charge you an extra commission because of the person who's been serving you. So we need to move away from commissions, and we should have fees that are based on the service that is being delivered, and they should be transparent. That would go to the heart of the financial services sector. As I have said, the financial services sector is addicted to commission-based selling. It's as heavily addicted as any drug addict is addicted to crack cocaine. And it will not be able to wean itself off this addiction. It will require legislation and strong enforcement to do that. But it's perfectly possible to do it. After all, we have a very large number of enormously highly paid people in the financial services sector, and it's not beyond their wit to devise alternative ways of selling and maintaining financial products. But it requires strong government action to force them to do that.
Yeah, well, I was also going to ask, what role do regulators and the government play in such a transition?
As the Royal Commission has clearly demonstrated, regulators have taken a very light touch approach to the regulation of the financial services sector and a light touch approach to any inappropriate action that's been taken by financial services providers. That can change, but I think we have to recognize that regulation, and particularly the reliance on self-regulation, isn't going to work in this circumstance. In exactly the same way that saying to a drug addict, we're going to trust you to wean yourself off this addiction, typically doesn't work. It requires an awful lot of external input and support. So we can't expect the financial services sector to change itself. One reason we can't expect that is that, as was said in the Royal Commission, many people who are paying commissions say, well, of course, we would be prepared to stop doing this if everyone else did. But if we are the first people who stop doing it, we'll lose business. That's what the companies have said to the Royal Commission, because they know that the sales force is motivated by earning the commission as much as they are, in some cases, motivated more by the commission than they are by providing any useful, sensible advice.
How will moving away from commission-based sales exactly help customers?
I think moving away from commission-based sales will help customers by forcing the providers to be clear, explicit and transparent about what they are charging. Commission-based selling is largely invisible. The nature of the commission is largely invisible, is not known, not understood by the client. So moving to upfront fees, and it has to be said, there are some financial advisors and some financial advice companies and some industry superannuation funds that have adopted a purely fee-based financial advice system. So the client says, what will it cost me for advice? And they are told it will cost you this much for advice. Do you want to purchase that advice or not? That's a transparent way of doing things. This would lead inevitably to a much smaller financial services sector or a much smaller financial advice sector, because the reality is a lot of the advice is not very good. Some of it is excellent, but a lot of it is not very good. And a lot of it is very, very formulaic. So clients have been paying very large sums of money for something that is a very, very standard bit of advice. And that increasingly can be provided through a sort of robo-advice system.
Warden and Director of the Forest Research Foundation and Professor of Economic History at the University of Western Australia, ending that report by Vincent Su. And that's all we have for you on The Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Hello if you're listening at 2 Wet Tank FM in Kempsey or 2 Bob Radio in Taree or 8CCC in Alice Springs. Thanks to our producers, Vincent Su and Vincent Su and a few others as well. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2SER.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter, look for @onthemoney2SER and find us on Facebook. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Think Inc. and the Jane Goodall Institute Australia are proud to present Jane Goodall, Rewind the Future, on May 8, 2019 at ICC Sydney. An original icon for conservation and animal welfare, Dr. Goodall will be live on stage to reflect on her life, the future, and how we can save our planet. Tickets available at thinkinc.org.au. Think Inc. is a partner of 2SER 107.3.
Animal Collective's Noah Lennox, a.k.a. Panda Bear, makes his highly anticipated Australian debut this December at Sydney Opera House. Panda Bear's impeccable experimental pop, coupled with stunning audio visuals, will create an entirely immersive atmosphere in the intimate Jones Sutherland Theatre. Book now for Panda Bear's Australian debut, December 16 at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors of 2SER.
You're listening to 2SER, a Sydney-wide broadcaster and strong supporter of local business. Spread the word about your business all over Sydney by sponsoring us. Head to 2ser.com/sponsor today. Stories, ideas, your business and music.
The Middle Path, the Middle Kingdom. Stuck in the middle? Listen to The Middle, the show where China and Australia meet and talk. History, racism, international students, Catch up with the big debates every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. on 2SER or on podcast, or with Mandarin subtitles on YouTube. Let the middle sort out the muddle about relations with China.